we have everything in place. Less people to worry about. Let's do this. You pay me what we agreed for my silence on tomorrow's auction, and we'll split what we make from this 50-50. He was instantly suspicious. Why so generous? Eli smiled. What choice does either of us have? I can ruin your auction tomorrow, and you can ruin this for me. Why don't we be reasonable and both profit? There's plenty here. He loved a good deal. Nothing better. All right, Eli. That's what we'll do.
Chapter 34. Tchaikovsky stood in his suite at the Sheraton and stared at Favel Castle. The ancient edifice was lit to the night in all its glory, 500 meters away, high above the River Vispa. Crowds gathered at its base along the wide walkways that paralleled the river, enjoying another magnificent June night. He felt a pride knowing that, as president, he was the natural successor to the many kings who'd ruled Poland from that castle, men like Bolesław the Brave, Kazimir the Restorer, Sigismund the Old. What names! What legends! Their right to the throne was first acquired by conquest, then retained through heredity. Eventually, though, it evolved into something uniquely Polish. Free election. What a mistake. The whole thing was hard to imagine. Ministers, archbishops, vivodes, castellans, and nobles gathered on vast meadows near Warsaw and arranged themselves into a circle. Contenders would send envoys who made presentations as to why their particular man should be king. Promises were extended, lots of them. Disputes arose. Physical violence was common. Eventually a vote would be taken and the man with the highest count won. Few other nations in the world chose its ruler in such a bizarre way. It reflected the Poles' strong belief in individual freedom and hatred of central authority. But the whole thing turned out to be disastrous. Kings, by definition, were meant to be independent and rule absolutely. But Polish kings were totally beholden to the nobles who elected them. Even worse, they had to abide by the promises they made to get elected. If they reneged, the nobles had the right to withdraw their allegiance. The results from such insanity were predictable. Monarchs became weak and ineffective. Most were not even Polish, as the tendency became to choose a foreigner with no local roots or connections. Those strangers cared little for the Polish nation, which led to countless unnecessary conflicts, both foreign and domestic. Civil wars raged. The time between the death of one monarch and the election of the next eventually evolved into years, which caused even more unrest. In turn, the power of the landowning nobles increased. They worked hard to keep the country rural, stifling the growth of cities and preventing the emergence of a middle class, none of which proved productive. Corruption became institutionalized. The same, Poland's lower house of parliamentary representatives grew in strength and stature, all at the further expense of the king, retaining for itself the final decisions on legislation, taxation, and foreign policy. Nothing became law without their approval. Then the Liberum Veto delivered the coup de grace. I freely forbid. One member of the Sejm could stop any piece of legislation. All votes had to be unanimous. Even more incredible, if they were unable to reach a unanimous decision on an issue within 6 weeks, the time limit of a single session, their deliberations were declared void and all previous acts of that session, even if passed and approved, were annulled. What insanity. The Liberum Veto brought Poland to near collapse. Good judgment finally prevailed, and it was abolished in 1791, but far too late, as the Polish nation itself was dissolved 4 years later. Thank goodness things had changed. But some of the bad tendencies remained. Poland still had a hard time moving forward, and still faced constant interference from foreigners. Jak ciebie, tak ciebie, how they see you, that's how they perceive you. an old Polish saying that still rang true. The door in the suite's outer room opened. It was manned by two of his BOR men, on guard in the hall. The hotel had been most accommodating with his last-minute booking. Luckily, the Royal Vauvel suite had been available and sat on an upper floor, at the end of a long hall, away from the elevators, an easy matter to secure access. He stepped from the bedroom and saw Sonia, who'd returned from the castle. "What happened?" he asked. "It went perfectly. Cotton took the spear and made his escape." "Anyone alerted?" She shook her head. "I personally handled it, with the guards none the wiser. They thought he was an intruder. I gave him just enough resistance to move him along, and he eventually fled the grounds through the dragon's den." He chuckled. "How appropriate." He stepped over to the small bar that had been set up for his visit and poured two generous measures of Irish whiskey. They'd discovered a mutual admiration for the beverage, so he'd asked that a bottle be made available, hoping she'd be here at some point. "Now the question is, will we learn the location of the auction?" he asked, offering her a glass and sipping from his own.
"We will.
Cotton will make sure of that." They wanted Malone to take the spear. They'd implanted a GPS marker in the wooden box that protected it, which should lead them straight to the auction site.
"What do you mean, he'll make sure we know?"
"Janos, Cotton is no fool. He certainly realizes that we allowed him to take the spear. He might be a little upset over the fall he took, but he'll get over it."
"If he knows, why take it?"
"It's America's ticket in, and he wants us to follow. He's headed into a blind situation, and he's being used by Tom Bunch and President Fox. He stayed in this because of Stephanie Nell. It's the only reason he would.
They used that loyalty to get him to steal the spear, and they'll use it to force him to go to the auction with Bunch. But he knows the Russians are not happy. That was made clear in Bruges. There could be trouble, so he's going to need some help. That's where we come in."
"Sounds like you know this man well."
"He's a pro.
He's also dealt with Ivan before, so he knows the man is not trustworthy. Cotton has to assume that the Russians are not telling us everything, especially the auction location. So he'll lead us there."
"You have great respect for him."
"Still jealous?"
"And what if I were?" he asked her.
"I'd say it's a strange reaction from a married man." He appraised her with a cautious gaze, the whiskey warming his chest.
"Why are you with me?"
He genuinely wanted to know.
"I work for you."
"That's not an answer, and you know it."
"Do you love me?"
He'd never asked her that question before.
"I do."
Her admission pleased him.
"I love you, too."
She enjoyed more of the whiskey.
"Was any of that in doubt?"
"Not doubt. But this whole thing is complicated."
She smiled.
"That it is.
But isn't the problem of this auction a bit more pressing than our personal lives?"
"They're both important to me." He'd not felt so vulnerable to a woman in a long time. Yes, he was still married, and the country would disapprove. The church would disapprove. His wife? Only if the press discovered any of it would she care. Thankfully, his security team was discreet and understanding. And now he found himself inside a magnificent suite, with a beautiful woman he loved, night firmly embraced outside, the day over. Another saying came to mind. Don't praise the day before sunset. First, though, he wanted to know, will there be any mention of the theft? She nodded. The castle is releasing a statement about the break-in, saying they are still determining what, if anything, may have been taken. The director was told this is a national security matter and secrecy is necessary. He's the only one who knows that we planned it all. I assured him the spear would be returned within 2 days. If we lose it, There's going to be trouble.
I know. I'll get it back.
Along with what's being auctioned on me.
That, too.
He finished his drink and laid their glasses down. Where is the box being tracked? She nodded.
Only on my phone.
And nothing more will be happening tonight. She shrugged.
I doubt it.
But we'll keep an eye on it. He took her into his arms.
How about we both do that?
Chapter 35. Cotton found the U.S. consulate located on a side street not far from Krakow's main square. A message on his phone indicated he was to go there after leaving the castle. He still carried the wooden box containing the Spear of St. Morris, the walk over through the night crowd uneventful. Two Marines stood guard at the main entrance. Three American flags hanging from the stone above waved an indolent welcome. The soldiers opened the door as he approached, obviously briefed to expect him. Inside, he was ushered past the metal detector and up a steep flight of stairs to a second-floor office where Stephanie and Bunch waited. He laid the box on a desk.
Well done,
Bunch said, a smile on his face. Stephanie did not appear to be as pleased. Bunch called for a screwdriver, brought by an eager young man, which he used to remove the top. Inside lay a dull-pointed iron spearhead, about 20 inches long and 3 inches wide. Its color reminded Cotton of battleship gray. The tattered remnants of a copper sleeve wrapped its midsection, partially covering an aperture chiseled from the top third of the blade. He knew it once harbored a nail, like the Spear of Destiny in Vienna, but the spike was gone. At its lower end were two wings, above which stretched a crisscross of wire. Below that was the round receptacle that once attached it to a lance. Bunch lifted out the artifact.
You think it might actually be the spear that pierced Christ?
He couldn't resist. Does a big white bunny bring candy to kids on Easter? Bunch wasn't amused.
I take it you are not a religious man.
I'm a practical man. No piece of iron, 2,000 years old, would have survived this intact.
Why not? It's possible.
Actually, it wasn't, but he decided not to argue. He did notice the clear disparity between this spear and the one on display in Vienna. Though similar in size and shape, that Spear of Destiny had a more pronounced oval aperture chiseled from its center where a forged iron pin still rested. Supposedly a nail from the crucifixion. A bright gold sheath protected it. Lots of testing had been performed on the Vienna spear, which revealed that it definitely had been forged, not molded, and its size was a bit large for those used by the Roman army at the time. Metallurgy testing dated the iron to long after Christ.
But who knew?
It was all a matter of faith. Something he'd never had much of. Bunch replaced the spear in the box.
That's the safest place for it.
On that, Cotton agreed. Bunch sat at the desk, faced an open laptop, and began typing. He then hit one final button and said, I just RSVP'd to the auction. The laptop immediately dinged, indicating an incoming message. That was fast. Had to be an auto-reply. Bunch read it, then turned the screen around so Cotton and Stephanie could see.
Thank you for participating. Please email an image of your artifact to this address. Then have your two representatives at the main branch of the Tatra Museum in Zakopane at 11 a.m. tomorrow. They will be returned there after the auction is concluded. No cell phones, weapons, or any electronics are allowed. No translators either, as the sale will be conducted in English only. Your representatives should be fluent. Payment verification will be made on site. Confirmation of payment must be received before the sale is concluded. Please ensure that all necessary arrangements for payment have been made. Any violations of these rules will result in a disqualification to bid.
Cotton thought about Ivan and his warning for the United States to stay out of this. He'd passed that on to Stephanie, who'd surely shared the information with Bunch. The Russians don't care about any of that, he said. They're going to either win or stop that auction no matter what.
We've dealt with that, too, Bunch noted.
President Fox has spoken with the Kremlin and related the same thing we told the Poles. He assured them we are not participating in the auction. Cotton pointed to the box. What happens when they find out that the spear has been stolen? Bunch shook his head. None of the other thefts have been made public. We've kept a lid on them. Incredible. These people really were stupid. None of the other thefts happened on Polish soil. That spear is not a Catholic relic stolen from a church. It's a national historical artifact. What's to stop President Tchaikovsky from telling the world it's gone? He has to know by now that you double-crossed him. Sonia Draga was there waiting for me. He omitted the why from that statement. Who cares? What can Tchaikovsky do about it? Bunch asked. Not a damn thing. Same with the Russians. We're the United States of America, for God's sake, and we're going to that auction with it. Cotton glanced at Stephanie, who kept her face stoic, but he could read her mind. The Russians and the Poles were working together. To what degree? Hard to say. If it was all that close a relationship, then the Poles would have simply stopped the theft of the spear. Instead, they allowed it to happen. That confirmed they were to some degree in the dark. How far? Another unknown. You and I will be at that museum in the morning, Bunch said to Stephanie. I assume Malone is done, right? You assume wrong, Cotton said. And he saw the surprise on Stephanie's face. I'll go with you, he said. Bunch smiled an irritating grin. That's what I like to hear. A team player, loyal to the good old US of A. We appreciate your dedication. He decided to not take that bait and instead said what was probably expected. And my $150,000. Let's not forget that. Paid in advance. No, of course not, Bunch said. A man has to make a living, right? We can appreciate that. I'll arrange the transfer of funds. Better for Fox to think him a greedy mercenary than a loyal friend. No way he was going to allow Stephanie to walk into that quagmire of an auction alone. And that was precisely what Tom Bunch represented. No help. Cotton considered himself an expert in only a few things. One was the ability to deal with a tight situation and think on his feet. The old cliché was true. Desperate people did desperate things. And this scenario seemed the precise definition of the word. Are you sure? Stephanie asked him. He nodded. Absolutely. Cotton and Stephanie stepped from the office while Bunch talked on the phone with Fox, motioning that he wanted to speak to the president in private. I wonder if there are classes in ass-kissing that idiots like him go to, he said to her. He has no appreciation for what's going on here. Not a drop. My guess is the box is GPS tagged, he said, and they're tracking it right now. We'll need to take a look. I know. We'll deal with that when he's done with his important call. He caught the sarcasm. Sonia set it all up, with just enough resistance to make it look good. Though shooting that rope was a bit much, he said. I owe her for that one. Stephanie smiled. It all means that the Poles didn't get an invite, he said. The Russians must have tipped them off to the whole thing. That would explain their partnership in Bruges. But it was a limited engagement. The Russians would not want anyone else involved after that. Unless they force themselves in, or allow us to lead them to it. He agreed. They'll put out a story on what happened tonight. They have to in order to stay consistent with the other thefts. And they can't allow the Russians to think they're cooperating with us in any way. He could see she agreed. Tchaikovsky will probably call Washington and raise hell at the lies, he said. That would be expected. Our problem is that the GPS marker will never make it to the auction. Based on the email we just saw, our transport tomorrow will check for tags, and if discovered, the U.S. will be disqualified. He smiled. We could leave it in, and this will all be over quickly. Bunch would even have to take some of the blame. I wish. but that information would still go on sale. I'm actually a little curious as to what's being offered. It's got to be pretty big. The White House didn't tell you? She shook her head. Not a word. And I'd be a liar if I said I wasn't curious, too. It has to be both personal and politically fatal. I say we keep going and see how it goes. He was okay with that. The Russians are not going to lose that auction. I know. But maybe it would not be a bad thing if they won. He caught the twinkle in her eye. I like the way you think. Chapter 36. Jaunty climbed into bed. He'd chosen the largest chamber in Sterneck Castle for his own, the one used long ago by the castle's lord, the room fully furnished with period pieces, all representative of Slovakia's past. Eli Reinhardt was down the hall, since he'd thought it a good idea to keep his newly acquired partner close. They'd left the cache of documents in the mine, replacing the salt wall and disguising their invasion as best they could. Conrad had assured them that level 10 was rarely accessed, since it was not actually part of the working mine. More a reminder from the past when the Soviets were in control. One few today cared to recall. So the secret should be safe. He'd promised Conrad some additional money, both to assure his silence and to cement his loyalty. They would need more visits to Level 10 in the weeks ahead as they determined what, if anything, there was to find. Unfortunately, Jaunty would be of little help, since his Polish was weak and his Russian non-existent. Eli, of course, was fluent in both, but he was not about to allow his partner unfettered access. That would only end with Eli keeping the most valuable information for himself. No. He'd hire a surrogate and pay him or her enough to ensure that person stayed loyal. To further cement the relationship, Vic would accompany them at all times, since a little fear was a good thing, both for Eli and for the hired help. Eli had kept Art Munoz as his own personal protection. The Bulgarian was ensconced in the bedroom next to Eli. Why the need for a bodyguard? Who knew? But he'd decided to allow Reinhardt whatever he wanted. The important thing was to get through tomorrow and conclude the auction. The 20 million euros he would owe Eli was a small price to pay for no drama. Yesterday's enemy can be today's friend. How true. Vic reported that 6 teams had been dispatched to various points in Poland, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and Austria, all within a few hours' driving time. The Germans would not be participating. Eli had assumed their place and provided the holy nail from Bamberg Cathedral, which would be sold with the rest of the holy relics. He'd been worried about the Americans, but now they were in. Finally. He'd received both the RSVP and an image of the Spear of St. Maurice. Their presence was essential. During their phone call a few weeks back, Warner Fox had assured him that they would not only bid, but actually win the auction, and that meant lots of U.S. dollars coming his way. Fox had been quite supportive of the endeavor, congratulating him on his enterprising ingenuity. More of that former businessman coming through, where money talked, and more money talked louder. He settled between the four posters, the firm mattress a wonder. The castle was wonderfully equipped. No expense had been spared in making it comfortable. For what he was paying for only a week's worth of use, the whole place should be lined with gold. Normally he liked to read before falling asleep. A habit he'd acquired as a teenager, and one he'd maintained his entire adult life. He loved the classics, but if truth be told, a good mystery intrigued him too. Something about the puzzle, much like his own life, which at times seemed straight out of an international suspense thriller. He was comforted to know that Vic was keeping an eye on things during the night. He doubted he'd be able to sleep otherwise. His man was also monitoring the 6 teams, ready to begin transportation of their charges in the morning. He'd chosen the middle of the day for the auction on purpose. Easier to spot trouble coming, and easier to get away. He trusted none of the bidders, but was counting on their parochial self-interests to ensure that all proceeded as planned. The pantry still bothered him. There were tens of thousands of documents there. It could take a long time to go through them, and there was no guarantee there'd be anything of value. Repeatedly going in and out of that mine could eventually draw attention, though Conrad had informed them of a way down where there was little to no monitoring, used exclusively by the miners. Still, one lesson he'd learned from years of careful bargaining was never press your luck. Take what was there and get out. Nothing good ever came from prolonging things, and everything about that cache screamed long term. Eli had been right about one thing. Why not make a deal with the Poles and sell it all intact? That would surely be worth millions of euros, and he'd derive half per his deal. He was hungry. Perhaps he should have the staff bring him a snack. Maybe a fruit bowl. Nothing heavy. He'd always found sleep hard to acquire after too much of a good thing. More of that never pressing your luck. He rested a little easier knowing that all communications in and out of the castle were now being jammed. They'd stepped up that precaution before leaving for the mine earlier, so there was no way Eli could speak to anyone beyond the castle walls. He was mindful, though, of Eli's threat about what would happen if he did not report in every few hours. So Vic had been told to allow those calls, but monitor every word. He was counting on his competitor's greed to ensure that nothing went wrong. He decided to pass on the snack and the reading. His mind was already racing, and any more stimulants should be avoided. He switched off the light. Time for sleep. Tomorrow would require his best.
Chapter 37, Thursday, June 6th, 10:50 a.m. Cotton had slept fitfully, concerned over what was about to happen. He'd spent the night at a Kraków hotel, but not before performing some vital housekeeping chores. He and Stephanie had managed to convince Tom Bunch that the spear should not be transported in its wooden box. Too informal, he'd explained. Not appropriate, Stephanie had added. So they'd located another decorative container of sufficient size, lacquered and hand-painted in the Polish style, and stuffed it with the foam and velvet cloth from the original box. Bunch had seemed satisfied, never realizing what was actually happening. Sure enough, they'd found a GPS tracker embedded into the original box's bottom, which Cotton had removed and now carried in his trouser pocket, still bouncing a signal to Sonia Draga. Stephanie had called earlier to tell him that a story in Warsaw's Morning Gazeta Wyborcza reported a burglary last night at Wawel Castle that was being investigated by the local police. Few details had been offered, and no determination had been made as yet on what might have been taken. That seemed more than enough to make the point, but not enough to give away the farm. He hadn't been able to eat much breakfast, just nibbling on some toast and sipping orange juice before they left Kraków in Bunch's vehicle and drove 60 miles south to Zakopane, a town of about 30,000 that sat on the Poland-Slovakia border. The city occupied a valley at the foot of the Tatra Mountains and billed itself as Poland's sports capital, catering to summer mountaineers and winter skiers. The Tatra Museum seemed like a big deal. There were 8 different locations, all featuring the history, culture, nature, and ethnography of the Polish Tatras. The main branch was located at the city center, the building a perfect example of the brick and stone variety that seemed typical in the area. Bunch had been buoyant on the drive, excited to be a part of the auction. It was clearly his first venture into something like this, and he seemed to have a twisted view as to how things were played. "It's like Mission Impossible," Bunch had said. "We're heading in on an assignment, on our own, and if either of us is captured or killed, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of our actions." The moron spouted out nonsense as if all that were a good thing. Who the hell liked to be disavowed? Agents were not suicidal. And killed? None he'd ever met had a death wish. They found the main branch of the museum at 10 Kropovsky Street and parked on the curb. They exited the car and stood on the sidewalk, outside a waist-high iron fence that encircled the building. Cotton glanced at his watch and saw they were in place with 5 minutes to spare. "When whoever arrives," he said, "it would be better if I did the talking. This has to be played carefully, and I do have some experience in this area." "I don't see the problem. We're here to go to an auction. There's nothing to play. I'm the senior official. I'll do the talking." Exactly what he thought Bunch would say. Perfect. He needed a little diversion, and this guy could certainly provide it. He figured whoever was coming would run an electronic sweep, so he had to be rid of the GPS marker before that happened. But he also needed to paint the way for Sonia, who was surely watching from afar. The day was clear, sunny, and warm. At precisely 11 a.m., a black Mercedes coupe came to a stop on the street before the museum. The driver and one other man sat in the front, both young, with a look and demeanor reminiscent of the Three Amigos in Bruges. Cotton walked toward the new arrivals and greeted the men as they emerged. He also noticed that the car windows were down. Perfect. All he needed now was for Bunch to be Bunch, who stepped up and said, "I'm the White House's Deputy National Security Advisor and Deputy Assistant to the President of the United States." "Where's the relic?" one of them asked. "What's the deal here?" Cotton asked. "It doesn't work like that. We ask the questions, you provide the answers, and we don't have time to debate things. Where is the relic?" Cotton pointed to their car. "In there." He'd managed to convince Bunch to leave it inside until they knew what was happening. "It's our only ticket into the auction," he'd told Bunch, who readily agreed. The two men headed for the car. Bunch did not hesitate. "Hold up there. That's ours, not yours. If you need to see it, I'll handle it." The moment provided Cotton an opportunity to remove the GPS tracker from his pocket and flick it through the Mercedes open window. Where it landed didn't matter, only that it was inside, preferably toward the back seat. The device was the size of a tic-tac and hopefully would go unnoticed. Bunch and the other two men made it to the car at the same time. "Stand back," one of them said. "You will not speak to me in such a manner. We've been instructed to leave you here if there is any objection or resistance to our instructions. Of course, we will take the relic with us." "You will not," Bunch made clear. "That is property of the United States of America." The guy chuckled. Cotton wanted to join him, but knew better. "It's actually stolen property," the other man said. "Please step aside and let us do our job." Bunch tossed over a look that asked, should he do that? And Cotton nodded. Amazing that he wanted some guidance, considering all his expertise with such matters. Bunch moved away, and the man removed the lacquered box from the rear seat. The other found a 9V-powered signal detector in his pant pocket, the kind that can be bought almost anywhere for under $200. Small, portable, simple, and effective. He switched on the unit and scanned the box. Then he opened the top lid and scanned the lens. Nothing registered. They then scanned Bunch. Clean. And finally they walked back to where Cotton stood and determined he harbored no electronic devices either. He and Bunch had left their cell phones back in Krakow with Stephanie. He was betting they would not scan their own car, and they did not, satisfied it was already clean. One disadvantage to a proximity scanner like they were using was that it needed to be close to any detectable source. "All right," one of their escorts said. "You need to get inside our vehicle and ride quietly." The other man took control of the spear inside its box. Bunch offered no argument. "We have a long drive ahead of us, and there are further precautions that must be taken." They rode for about half an hour, over the border into Slovakia, through the Tatra Mountains. No one spoke. Cotton tried to grab his bearings, knowing they were headed due south. He was not familiar with northern Slovakia, so it was hard to say where their destination lay. Ahead, he spotted a tunnel cut into the mountain, allowing the highway to keep on a straight course, unobstructed. They entered the tunnel, which was artificially lit, and he saw that it was a long one, the other end visible about a quarter mile away. Cars were coming from the opposite direction in the other lane. One passed, then a second. A third car slowed, then did a U-turn in the road, falling into line behind them. A black Mercedes coupe, identical to theirs, which sped past and headed for the tunnel's end. Their car came to a stop in the small service lane. The driver switched on his emergency flashers. "Why have we stopped?" Bunch asked. Cotton realized what was happening. Drones. Bunch seemed puzzled. "They're afraid we're watching from overhead," he said to Bunch. "So they bring in an identical car that will now take any eyes in the sky off on a wild goose chase." The guy in the passenger seat turned around. "I said no talking." He'd had enough. "Then do something about it." He was banking on the fact that Jonty Olivier wanted America in this show so much, he was willing to waive just about anything, including the rules. But if this guy wanted to go toe-to-toe, that was fine by him. The guy turned back around. "We'll be waiting here a few minutes," he said to Bunch, "long enough to give the decoy time to do its job." The guy in the front seat turned around and tossed two black cloth sacks their way. "Once we get moving, put those on your head." More old school. But an effective way to keep someone from learning where they were headed. He decided not to argue, hoping Sonya stayed on the trail. Chapter 38. Tchaikovsky decided to stay in Krakow for the day, wanting to be nearby so he and Sonya could communicate quickly in person. Michal Zhima, the head of the BOR, had not been pleased with the decision, preferring to have the president of the nation within the controlled environs of Warsaw. He realized that Zhima wanted to know what was happening, and why an agent of the Agencia Viviadu was so directly involved with the president. That was unusual, to say the least, but he'd rebuffed all of Zhima's renewed overtures to learn more. His night with Sonya had been wonderful. He was beginning to miss not having her around. But feelings like that could be dangerous, so he quelled any notions of emotional attachment. Those could be dealt with later. At the moment, the auction was all that mattered. Sonya had shown him the tracking device on her phone and that the Spear of St. Morris had spent the night at the American consulate. Her last report was that the Spear had left Krakow and been taken south to the Poland-Slovakia border, but that had been nearly 2 hours ago. No telling what was happening now. He could only hope that Sonya stayed with it. They'd discussed all the options, and in the end he told her to use her best judgment as to what had to be done. He trusted her implicitly, but he also had to be prepared to deal with the situation if she failed. He realized there was no way he could deny any of the documents' authenticity, since they were all either in his handwriting or signed by him. The one showed to Sonya by the Russians seemed representative of what he recalled providing to the SB. He'd worked as a paid informant for 7 years, from mid-1982 until late 1989. Deletsky had been his main contact point, though others had from time to time been involved. All informants were required to provide regular reports. If not, they were subject to being rounded up and interrogated. For him, that had meant contact with somebody in the SB every couple of months. Something. Anything. Once someone came onto the SB's radar, it was nearly impossible to get off. You either provided what they wanted, or you ended up like that math professor, strapped naked to a stool and beaten savagely. Or worse. Defending himself now was going to be next to impossible. The documents themselves would be damning, and to his knowledge, only a handful of people had known the truth. Not even Wałęsa, who'd headed Solidarity, had been aware of all that had been happening. And it all started that day in Warsaw, when he left Mokotów prison. A few minutes before, he'd been watching a man being tortured, the implications clear that he would be next unless he cooperated with the SB. Then, the next... The clamor of a car horn brought him back to reality. He'd stepped into the street without looking. Thankfully, the driver was paying attention and had stopped. He stared through the windshield at an older man who continued to pound the horn. He tossed him a wave and kept going, finding the sidewalk on the other side. the image of that professor, a learned man entitled to respect and dignity, crawling across the filthy prison floor, bleeding and naked, would never leave his mind. Nor would the defiance. He hated Deletsky. He hated the SB. He hated the communists, the government, and anyone and everything that opposed a free and independent Poland. Nothing and no one would ever change that belief inside him. But he'd been afraid, more so than any time in his life. He did not want to be strapped to a stool, then beaten and kicked. He did not want to be tortured or defiled. He did not want to crawl across the floor. But he also did not want to be the eyes and ears of the oppressors. He walked down the sidewalk, busy with people. There was a meeting of the local chapter of Solidarity in 2 hours, one that Deletsky knew all about, demanding a full report of what was said. Your first test, the irritating bastard had made clear. He turned a corner and kept heading away from the prison. 3 men blocked his way ahead, standing shoulder to shoulder on the sidewalk, waiting for him to approach. He knew them, and the look on their faces was anything but cordial. Come with us, one of them said. He'd already been intimidated by the state. He was not about to allow his own people to do the same thing. Go screw yourself, he said to them. He turned to walk away, and one of them grabbed his arm. He wrenched it free. Please, the man said to him. Somebody wants to speak with you. He'd thought all that over, finished, never to be heard of again. But that was not the case. Far from it, in fact. He sat alone in the hotel suite. He was in constant communication with his staff in Warsaw, dealing with everyday problems. A lot was going on. A dispute with the European Union over local self-government seemed to be heating up. Preparations for the upcoming national budget had begun. Measures were being discussed to lessen inflation, which had recently been creeping higher. All issues that required his undivided attention. Yet he was divided, with the past intruding on the present. He'd resisted making the telephone call as long as possible. But it had to be done. His personal secretary had found the contact number 2 weeks ago. But the time had not been right then. Now was the moment. He reached for the cell phone. Sonia had provided him the unit, noting it would be untraceable. He punched in the number and waited while it rang in his ear. When it was finally answered, he realized that the voice had changed little in nearly 30 years. A voice he'd heard for the first time that fateful day after Makotov prison, in a conversation that changed his life. I need your help, he said into the phone. Interesting how time has shifted our positions. Once it was I who needed your assistance. What can I do for you, Mr. President? We have to discuss the Warsaw Protocol. Chapter 39. Jonty excused himself from his guests and left the Great Hall, walking back to the castle's main foyer, where he'd been told another pair of bidders was arriving. The Iranians, French, and Chinese were already on site, their escorts assuring Vic that everything seemed fine. No tales, no problems. He'd dressed for the day, wearing a new suit specially made by a tailor in Paris. Usually French high fashion for men centered on Balmain, Saint Laurent, and Dior. But he preferred the newcomer labels, places like APC, AMI, and Maison Kitsune. His girth made for a challenge in crafting an acceptable look, but he genuinely loved the berets, waistcoats, and lapel pins, a mix of classic with more comfort-driven attire, the whole look more English than French. Today's ensemble was a perfect example. Smart, with a tweed jacket, the fleck of the sturdy wool offset by a pale blue cotton shirt, bow tie, and leather shoes. He thought it important to personally welcome the bidders, showing them courtesy and hospitality. Each so far had appreciated the gesture, offering their part of the Arma Christi as a welcome, depositing it onto the oak table upon entering the great hall. The sight seemed to be working its magic. All of the arrivals impressed by the surroundings and the array of uniformed staff toting trays of fresh hors d'oeuvres and drinks appropriate to each nationality.
His expert was also on site, brought in earlier by Vic to verify the authenticity of each relic. So far, everything had seemed in order, all deemed authentic, including the nail from Bomberg. Now a fourth participant was arriving. He stepped from the foyer out into the bright morning sun. The Slovakian weather was cooperating with another glorious late spring day. A black Mercedes coupe motored into the courtyard and came to a stop. Two men emerged from the back seat. Tall, dark suits, broad-shouldered, Slavic features. Russians. And neither man looked happy to be there. "Welcome, gentlemen," he said to them in English. One of them answered with a few lines of Russian. He did not need a translator to know the meaning. He waved a finger. "As advertised, this auction will be conducted in English." Neither said a word. He continued, "I apologize for the insistence, and I mean no disrespect. But please know every effort has been made to make you as comfortable as possible. We have some lovely pyamini wrapped in light paper-thin dough." He patted his midsection and laughed. "As you can see, I've enjoyed a few. I chose the filling myself, a combination of beef, lamb, and pork, spiced with pepper, onions, and garlic. I assure you, they are quite delicious." Both Russians broke into a smile.
"How can we refuse such generosity?" the one said in English that tended to thicken the consonants and round the vowels. "I have not had a good pyamini in some time."
He noticed that the other man held a small wooden box.
"Is that the holy blood from Bruges?"
"It is indeed." The man handed it over. "Our ticket to enter."
He led his new guests into the castle and down a wide corridor to the great hall. He watched as, like the others already there, the new arrivals surveyed the room to ascertain who else would be bidding. He excused himself and caught the attention of the head waiter, who immediately marched over.
"Please make sure the Russians have whatever they desire to drink. Mention the Tovarich vodka we have on hand, and bring out the pyamini."
The man hurried off. He, too, glanced around the room. Four teams there, two to go. Both were en route. He glanced up at the second-floor railing and spotted Eli taking in the scene. Beside him stood Art Munoz, looking as dour as ever. Jaunty had tried to apologize for the wire-down-the-throat business, but the Bulgarian had not been receptive. He'd even offered some generous monetary compensation for the pain and suffering, which was also refused. Apparently, this Bulgarian was not the forgiving type. Eli tossed him a casual wave, as if to say that he was pleased things were progressing. Germany's two chairs in the Great Hall had been removed, and Eli would watch the proceedings from the second floor out of sight. They'd already agreed to make another trip into the mine in 2 days' time to begin a cursory inspection of the containers. He was on the prowl for an expert, one with the historical knowledge along with the discretion to work quickly and quietly. He still liked the idea of selling it all en masse to the Poles. But that would be a discussion for another day. The auction was all that mattered now. Vic entered the hall and approached.
"The other two teams will be here within the half hour.
Is everything okay?"
"So far, no problems. But that doesn't mean there won't be any."
He agreed. The Iranians and the Russians would be the most dangerous. Both had a lot to lose from American missiles in Poland. Both had few to no scruples and were capable of almost anything. He was betting on them to use money instead of violence, maybe even join forces to raise their bid to astronomical levels, forcing America to counter even higher. The possibilities seemed endless. He checked his watch. Everything would start soon. Chapter 40 Cotton sat in the back seat with a black cloth bag over his head, feeling like a fool. Bunch didn't seem to mind, as he'd not said a word over the past 20 minutes. They'd waited in the tunnel for the decoy Mercedes to lead away any drone that may have been observing. A bit overdramatic in scope, but, he had to admit, effective. obviously. A lot of planning had gone into this. They'd stayed on a smooth road for most of the way, maintaining a constant rate of speed south with no stops. That meant a major highway, as there'd been few curves. Then a turn to the west and a curvy path that first ground its way up, then leveled off.
"You can take the hoods off," one of the men said.
He yanked the cloth off his head, and it took a moment for his eyes to adjust to the sunlight. And he saw a castle. The Mercedes motored beneath a heavy iron-studded gate, protected by a portcullis, which had been raised to admit them. A stonemason's sign on the rough wall bore the inscription, 1564. They entered a graveled courtyard, five-sided. Towers rose to the bright sky, each crowned with a cupola. Some kind of Slovakian fortress. A rotund man in a tweed jacket and bow tie waited near a pedimented door.
"That's Jaunty Olivier," Bunch whispered.
The Mercedes came to a stop. Cotton gave the rear floorboard a quick once-over, trying to find the tracker, but saw nothing. He could only hope no one ever noticed it.
"You can get out," the driver said.
He glanced at Bunch, who never hesitated, grabbing the black lacquered box with the spear and opening his door. So much for coordinating how they would handle things.
"Gentlemen," Jaunty Olivier said, his arms spread wide. "Welcome."
Bunch extended a hand, which Olivier shook.
"You work with President Fox?"
"I do," Bunch said. "He sent me personally to handle this.
I believe you and the president spoke."
Olivier raised a finger to his lips and shushed Bunch quiet.
"That's a secret between us. Not everyone received such personal attention."
Cotton tried to gauge their host. Fashion conscious? It certainly seemed so. Self-assured, definitely. In control. That was the impression the man was trying to convey.
"This is for you," Bunch said, offering the box.
"The Spear of St. Maurice. How utterly exciting. Please, bring it inside."
Olivier motioned for them to follow.
"We have a special place for it."
Cotton studied the castle as they were led into what appeared to be its grand hall. Stout black pillars bore the weight of a flattened vaulted ceiling. A huge open hearth at one end bore the coat of arms of a former owner. Glass windows in black iron frames high up allowed in the late morning sun. Four massive, electrified, gilded bronze chandeliers provided ample illumination. Eight people milled about, chatting among themselves. Servers offered food and drink. Six pairs of chairs were arranged at the far end, facing a single high-backed chair and a large video screen. Olivier led them to a long oak table supported by legs the size of tree trunks. A portrait of Christ embossed into a copper plate, displayed on an easel, decorated the center. Four other artifacts lay about: the holy sponge, the pillar of flogging, the true cross, and the holy blood. That meant the Russians were here, but he did not recognize any of the people in the room. Bunch laid the box on the table, opened the lid, and withdrew the spear. Olivier seemed impressed, which was surely Bunch's intention.
"Quite wonderful," Olivier noted. "Thank you for bringing it."
"Like we had a choice," Cotton said. Olivier chuckled, merriment in his watery eyes.
"No, I don't suppose you did, but I thank you nonetheless. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have other guests arriving."
Two more pairs, in fact. Who would bring the holy nail and the crown of thorns? Olivier waddled off. Bunch seemed pleased with himself. So far, so good. Right, Malone? That all depended. But he wasn't about to discuss those possibilities with his idiot. Hopefully, somewhere out there, Sonia Drago was coming this way. He'd seen little security, but that did not mean none existed. No cameras ringed the great hall, but again, they could be concealed. He'd noticed an older man on the second floor, peering down from the stone balustrade, watching with great intensity. Just one more odd thing to add to the list. Bunch captured a flute of champagne from a passing tray and motioned to ask if he should take another. Cotton shook his head and walked over to a table where ice water was being offered and poured himself a glass. He assumed they were about 40 to 50 miles inside Slovakia. He hadn't been able to see any of what was beyond the castle, as the courtyard had totally blocked his field of vision, and the windows here, in the great hall, were too high up. Olivier had made sure that there would be little to nothing that could be used to pinpoint a location. That should not hinder Sonia. But what exactly would she do? Good question. He glanced across at the delegates and wondered if any of them had also managed to lead the way for someone else. Or was he the only bird dog on this hunt? Bunch sauntered over and approached the Chinese delegation. One of the serving staff removed the holy lance from the table and carried it off, most likely to confirm authenticity. But this auction wasn't about sacred relics. They were merely icing. The cake was damaging information on the current president of Poland.
Malone, Bunch called out. Come over here. I want to introduce you.
The man was oblivious to anything and everything beyond himself. But something about this whole setup screamed trouble. And he still wondered about the older guy in the second floor gallery. Who was he? And why was he there?
Chapter 41. Tchaikovsky liked the fact that no one recognized him. He'd dressed in casual clothes and blended in easily with the hundreds of people that surrounded him. Most were foreign tourists, many pilgrims, their presence understandable given he was entering Poland's spiritual capital. An abbey had stood on the hill beneath him since the 13th century, manned continuously by the Pauline fathers. It grew into a fortified complex of thick stone walls that had withstood multiple sieges, the most notable from the Swedes in 1655. The nearby town of Częstochowa, along the river Warta, had always been a center for trade, and now was a major industrial center for metals, textiles, and chemicals. He'd left Kraków in an unmarked car with two of his security detail. The drive north had taken a little over an hour through a picturesque stretch of limestone hills called the Jurassic Upland. Many of the mounds, which stretched for hundreds of miles in both directions, were crowned with castle ruins in what had come to be labeled the Trail of the Eagle's Nest, another popular destination. Buses flooded there every day, offering tourists some amazing photo opportunities of sites that once protected Poland from invaders. He followed the crowds and climbed the wide stone steps, passing beneath the first of four gates that led into Jasna Góra Monastery. They were not only highly ornamented and strikingly beautiful, but practical too, since they presented an invader with multiple challenges to gain entry. The rest of the monastery was surrounded by thick bastions with ramparts at each corner, all defensive in nature. Every day, from dawn to dusk, streams of pilgrims approached the monastery via a long tree-lined avenue that led into town. He'd passed today's visitors on the drive-in, the groups deep in prayer and singing hymns. Many of the pilgrims wore badges with the name of their hometown and a number showing how many times they'd come before. Fitting that he, too, was making a pilgrimage, only of a different kind, with a different purpose. He passed through the last gate and entered an enclosed area surrounded by buildings. Waiting for him was a stout, white-robed man with a neck and chin covered in a thick, matted beard. The man had aged in the years since he'd last seen him, the belly a bit fuller, hair thinner, the jowls drooping. Interesting that this man, whom he knew to be clever, tough, resourceful, and completely without conscience, had become a monk. "So wonderful to see you again," the man greeted. It had been 2 decades since their paths had last crossed. "Mirek, or should I say Father Hatje, it's wonderful to see you too." His old friend extended a hand, more like a paw, which he accepted and shook. The grip remained hard and firm. His two security men stood a few feet away, trying to blend in. People streamed in and out from the nearby ticket office. He knew that all of the tours were guided by monks. "Not working today?" he asked Mirek. "I was, until you call."
He caught the glint in the older man's eyes. Just like the old days.
"Shall we go inside?" Mirek said, "where we can have some privacy."
He turned to his security men and told them to wait in place. Neither was happy about that decision, but no arguments were offered. Above him rose a tower, over 100 meters, one of the tallest in the country, topped by a cross. About a third of the way up the cream-colored brick facade, a clock face read 11:50 a.m. He could not linger long. Sonia would be dealing with the auction soon, and he had to be available when she called. But this had to be done. Miroslav Mirek Hatcher once served a high position within Solidarity. Of course, he was also much younger, as they all were back then. Hatcher's job was not one that the organization had ever publicly recognized. His name had never appeared in any of the countless books that had been written about the movement. Only a few had known of his existence. But he was a man with a razor-sharp mind and a vast repertoire of talents. Tchaikovsky only learned of him after his unexpected visit to Makotov prison, when he was confronted on the street by 3 men and led away to an apartment in a crowded Warsaw neighborhood. Mirek had been waiting there. "Please, Janusz, have a seat." "How do you know my name?" "It's my job to know those things." He remained standing. "What do you want with me?" "We need your help." "Who is we?" "Your country. Your brothers in the fight against the oppressors. Solidarity. Choose one."
"You know where I've just been."
Hatcher nodded.
"That is exactly why we need your help."
He was so confused. First, the government had coerced him, wanting from him that which he could never deliver. Now his own people were doing the same thing.
"What do you want?" he asked again.
"Are you still forcing people into doing what you desire?" he asked Mirek as they walked. "There's not much call for my services within the order. I dedicate myself these days to more selfless endeavors." He doubted that, since this man had headed Solidarity's most secret intelligence and counterintelligence units. For more than 10 years, Mirek had wreaked havoc with the ESB, disrupting the security services at every turn, turning their own tactics against them, creating nothing but chaos. They entered the Basilica of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary and Founding of the Holy Cross, an enormous brick and stone structure elongated toward the north. Its vaulted ceiling was covered in rich stucco frameworks, everything colorful and airy. Frescoes abounded, as did polychrome paintings, all geared to the Virgin Mary. Appropriate, since the entire monastery was a Marian shrine. Groups of people milled about admiring the spectacle, all accompanied by white-robed guides. Mirek had stayed within Solidarity until 1991. Once Wałęsa had been elected president, there was no further need for his services. He'd then moved into the government and worked there for a while, but eventually faded away. About 10 years ago, he resurfaced as a Pauline monk.
"Why did you turn to the church?"
Mirek shrugged. "God called me," I simply answered. Short, concise, to the point. Classic Mirek.
"I never thought of you as religious," he said. "Not ever."
"Faith is a personal matter. One we keep to ourselves. But with what we did, faith seemed the only way for me to stay sane." That was true. Faith among those who once fought the communists had been strong. The church had played a key role in all that happened, aided by the fact that the Pope at the time was Polish. Many took that as a sign from God that they were on the right track.
"Now it is my life," Mirek said.
And he believed that. Mirek, if nothing else, was a pragmatic man, and whatever he did well. Their first encounter in 1982 had been both unexpected and confrontational. But after that, they became more than colleagues, perhaps even friends. Until 1991, they worked closely together behind the scenes, implementing what they called the Warsaw Protocol. Mirek stopped, standing beside him.
It's interesting, is it not? The two of us here, and no one seems to know who we are. Me? That's understandable. I was always anonymous. But you? Once anonymous, but no longer.
Several hundred people roamed about around them, many headed toward the Chapel of the Miraculous Image, the main reason why pilgrims traveled to this holy spot.
This is about as anonymous as my job ever gets, he said.
What's happening?
Mirek finally asked in a whisper, his old friend's gaze still out into the basilica.
The past is coming back. Did you ever think it gone?
I'd hoped so. I was wrong.
A wise person once said that the past cannot be changed. Only the future is in our power.
I prefer what Napoleon said. If we open a quarrel between past and present, we shall find that we have lost the future.
Mirek chuckled.
And the election is fast approaching.
Precisely.
Is it that bad? Enough that you and I have to deal with it. Just you and I?
No. Thankfully.
I have other resources, and they too are dealing with it as we speak.
Mirek motioned ahead.
Then let us visit with Our Lady, and see if she can help us find wisdom.
Chapter 42 Jonty surveyed the great hall for the final time. Everyone had arrived, and now all six delegations were milling about, enjoying food, drink, and conversation. Even the Iranians and North Koreans, who seemed far more cordial than he'd envisioned. Frequent visits of the servers offering fresh trays of food and drink attested to the growing ease among the bidders. His expert had verified that all seven of the Arma Christi were authentic, which was good news, and they were safely tucked away in a car, just beyond the inner courtyard, awaiting him after the auction. The expert had been paid and was gone. He and Vic would leave as soon as the business was concluded. He'd deal with Eli tomorrow from long distance. Reinhardt and his sidekick were behaving themselves, disappearing from the second-floor gallery, prepared to listen to the auction from an open upper bedroom door out of sight. He was certain that everyone was nervous, considering they would be bidding against one another, each wondering if the other might do something stupid. Vic's latest report was that all remained quiet both inside the castle and beyond. He checked his pocket watch.
A Breguet, 18-karat gold, hand-engraved on a rose engine, nearly $750,000 U.S., a gift to himself after another lucrative deal.
He'd have to reward himself big after today. Outside, a sonorous bell unleashed a cascade of peals. Noon.
Shall we get started? He called out.
Cotton headed for the two chairs adorned by an American flag. He noted that the other bidders were likewise denoted by their respective national colors. France, Iran, Russia, China, North Korea. He wondered why Great Britain and Germany were not involved, but perhaps they'd declined. He recalled that the Arma Christi consisted of seven relics, but only six had been on the oak table. Where was the holy nail? And who was the older man that had been staring down from the second-floor gallery? He hadn't seen him the past 20 minutes. Not knowing the players, the room, the house, or even where he was located was unsettling, to say the least. But he'd been in worse situations. Tom Bunch remained oblivious, busy socializing with the French. It seemed everyone here had heeded the warning in the email instructions regarding no translators. They all spoke English.
This is all so exciting, Bunch said as they took their seats. We're right in the middle of the storm.
You do realize that the eye of a storm is the worst place to be, since that means trouble is raging all around you.
Quit being such a pessimist. Here we are, representing our country, about to buy some information that will allow us to stick it to the Russians and the Iranians at the same time. How many chances at that do you get?
Not many, Malone. Not many at all.
On a small wooden table before them were two notepads and pencils, a carafe of ice water, two glasses, and a sealed manila envelope upon which was written, "Do not open until instructed." Cotton noticed that the servers had all withdrawn, and the room's heavy oak doors were closed. Jaunty Olivier stepped to the front of the assemblage, beside a big screen television supported by a thick wooden frame. "I want to formally welcome everyone and thank you for participating. I know you're anxious, but prior to conducting the bidding, I have some documents to show you. Each of you was provided a sample at the time of your invitation. Now I would like to share a bit more, as a good faith offering to demonstrate the wealth and value of the information that is for sale here today." "We appreciate that," Bunch called out. "Nobody likes to buy a pig in a poke." Cotton caught the curious look on the faces in the hall. Probably not a phrase many outside of America had much familiarity with. "No, Mr. Bunch," Olivier said, "no one ever likes to do that. And we will make sure no one buys a problem today. Everything I have for sale is authentic. Now, some further instructions before we begin. I want everyone to conduct themselves with courtesy and respect. Civility is expected. As you can see, I have not employed any security personnel to keep order. I am trusting each of you to maintain a proper decorum. Are we clear?"
"We not children," one of the Russians said.
"Certainly not," Olivier replied. "But you are all passionate people, here on a mission, with differing goals and objectives. That can lead to irrational thinking. Let us not have any of that." No one else chimed in.
"All right. Please open the envelope before you. Remove the clipped stack of documents and place them on the table."
Jaunty stepped over to the big screen television facing his 12 guests, black at the moment, but about to come alive thanks to the laptop connected to it, resting on a shelf behind. The agenda was simple. Tantalize them with more of what he possessed. Then, once their appetite had been whetted, open the bidding. Everyone had already been notified that the auction was with reserve, which meant he could reject any offer prior to accepting the final bid. And for good reason. He had no intention of selling what he had cheap. What would the ultimate price be? Hard to say. He'd make a decision on what to accept as things progressed. He resisted the urge to glance upward at the second-floor gallery, not wanting to draw any attention that way. He'd told Eli to stay out of sight, and it appeared his nemesis was heeding that directive. Vic knew to keep an eye on things and would alert him of anything out of the ordinary. Everyone else was gone from the premises, as previously arranged, including all of the drivers and staff. They would be recalled when the proceedings were over. His focus now turned to the people in the great hall. He switched on the screen. "Please remove the top blank sheet on the stack before you." He punched a key on the laptop and brought a document up. A crisp, high-resolution image. "Let me explain what we are seeing."
Chapter 43. Tchaikovsky entered the chapel of the miraculous image, a tight, compact space topped by a ribbed Gothic vault. Cordovan protected the lower walls, a gold-plated leather decorated with ornaments and impressions. At the far end, just past the ebony and silver altar, set amid a background of Baroque, hung the image that millions of pilgrims came from all over the world to adore. Our Lady of Yasna Gora. A black Madonna. Not all that large, its ornate wooden frame about 100 centimeters tall and 80 wide, resting under a canopy, as if on a throne. The image was of a half-figure of Mary, with the child Jesus in her arms, both figures dark-skinned in the Byzantine style, their faces lost in reflection, gilded halos filled with gems wrapping their heads. Mary wore a blue cloak dotted with golden lilies, the baby a carmine robe. His left hand held a book, and the right extended outward in a gesture of blessing, symbolic of the way to salvation. The lady's face was beautiful, piercing the onlooker with deep piety. People called her Ahotagetria, she who knows the way. Legend proclaimed that it was painted by St. Luke the Evangelist upon a plank from the table at which the Holy Family ate. Reality was far different. It was a Balkan image created during the Middle Ages, tempera on canvas, attached to three lime tree boards, claimed as a war prize by a Polish prince and presented to the monastery. Miracles had always been associated with the image, particularly physical healing. That drew pilgrims, who'd come for centuries, many bringing votive gifts in return for a miraculous intercession. Many of those gifts now adorned the chapel walls as a testimony of thanks. After Hussites raided in the 15th century and vandalized the image, it was restored. But the parallel slashes on Mary's cheek were left, impregnated with red cinnabar, the marks another symbol of Poland's constant scars. Today the chapel was full of worshippers searching for consolation and deliverance, many approaching the image on their knees, as was customary, a sign of humility and respect. Even Hitler had shown Our Lady deference, taking the monastery but not touching the image, only forbidding anyone from worshipping. But that did not stop the Poles, who continued to come in secret all during the war. Mirek performed the sign of the cross, and he followed suit. His faith remained strong, and he firmly believed that the Virgin Mary's presence was here. He knew several people who'd been healed from a visit. They stood at the rear of the reverent crowd, beyond a stout railing, the room in utter silence, only the scrape of cloth from the knees to stone disturbing the silence. A nearby showcase featured canes, crutches, and other medical devices left behind by people who'd been cured. Quite a testimonial. His old friend seemed to be in deep prayer, so he joined him in the traditional plea. Holy Mother of Częstochowa, thou art full of grace, goodness, and mercy. I consecrate to thee all my thoughts, words, and actions, my soul and body. I beseech thy blessings and especially prayers for my salvation. Today, I consecrate myself to thee, good Mother, totally, with body and soul, amid joy and sufferings, to obtain for myself and others thy blessings on this earth and eternal life in heaven. He muttered an amen and hoped it helped, as his troubles were mounting by the moment. Every minute he spent here was another minute he would not hear from Sonia. Cell phones were not allowed inside the monastery, and that prohibition included the presence